On the Negro's Place in Nature, Part 2. The opinion of Dr. Channing of America is often quoted respecting the Negro. He says, quote, "I would expect from the Negro race, when civilized, less energy, less courage, less intellectual originality than in ours, but more amiableness, tranquility, gentleness, and content." Close quote. Now, if it were possible to civilize them, there is no doubt they would show less energy, courage, and intellectual originality, of which they would be utterly deficient. And as to their amiableness, tranquility, gentleness, and content, it would be more like the tranquility and content shown by some of our domestic animals than anything else to which we can compare it. It has been said that the present slaveholders of America, quote, "no more think of insurrection among their full-blooded slaves than they do of rebellion among their cows and horses," close quote. It has also been affirmed, and I believe with truth, that not a single soldier has been required to keep order in the so-called slave states of America. The many assumed cases of civilized Negroes generally are not those of pure African blood. In the southern states of North America, in the West Indies and other places, it has been frequently observed that the Negroes in place of trust have European features, and some writers have supposed that these changes have been due to a gradual improvement in the Negro race, which is taking place under favourable circumstances. It is assumed that great improvement has taken place in the intellect of the Negro by education, but we believe such not to be the fact. It is simply the European blood in their veins which renders them fit for places of power, and they often use this power far more cruelly than either of the pure-blooded races. At the same time, there are doubtless many exceptions to this rule, depending perhaps on the amount of mixture of blood and inherited peculiarities. It has been affirmed that occasionally there are seen Negroes of pure blood who possess European features. But I believe such not to be the fact. And Pruna Bay also says that, quote, "with regard to the regular Caucasian features, with which some travellers have endowed certain Negro peoples, I must state that among many thousand Negroes who have come under my own observation, there was not one who could lay claim to it." Close quote. Instances have often been quoted of reputed European skulls with Negro characters. Such an instance there is in the College of Surgeons, another in Morton's Museum, and one in Gall's collection. But if we admit these to have belonged to the pure race, we shall only be admitting that in one character, the European skull sometimes resembles that of the Negro. But there will be plenty of other characters to show that they did not belong to the same race or species. And it ought simply to caution us not to base our ideas of race or species upon one character. We know that species of the mammalia frequently cannot be distinguished by the form of the skeleton, and we must therefore not be surprised to find that we are unable to prove a distinction of species in mankind if we take the cranium or even the skeleton as a sole test. We now know it to be a patent fact that there are races existing which have no history, and that the Negro is one of these races. From the most remote antiquity, the Negro race seems to have been what it is now. We may be pretty sure that the Negro race has been without a progressive history, and that Negroes have been for thousands of years the uncivilized race that they are at this moment. Egyptian monuments depict them as such, and holding exactly the same position relative to the European. Morton truly observes, quote, "Negroes were numerous in Egypt, but their social position in ancient times was the same that it is now, that of servants and slaves." Close quote. Some writers have assumed that the Negro has degenerated from some higher form of civilization, but we see no evidence to support such an assertion. We, however, fully admit that there are found traces of a higher civilization, especially along the coasts visited during all ages by Europeans. The working of metals and imitation of European manufactures also exist in many parts of Africa. Indeed, there seems to be a great sameness in this respect throughout all Africa. Consul Hutchinson has given an interesting account of the finding of some implements used by the natives of Central Africa, exactly resembling those used by the Anglo-Saxons. Consul Hutchinson thus describes them, quote, "You'll be surprised, no doubt, to hear that I brought down with me from the tribes of Filatas in Central Africa iron heads of spears with wooden shafts and iron-spiked ferrules, heads of javelins and arrows, double-edged swords, knives, beads for ornaments, potteryware for culinary purpose, exactly similar in pattern to those that are described by Mr. Wright in a paper on Fawcett Antiquities, which he read before the British Association at Liverpool in 1856, and which antiquities, I need scarcely tell you, were excavated at Canterbury, as well as proved to have been used in this country before the introduction of Christianity to our shores. Even the cowrie, the shell of the Cyprae monata, which is described in Mr. Wright's paper as having been found among other relics of our Anglo-Saxon forefathers, is in this very day the currency among the Filatas. It may perhaps increase the interest of my statement, which can be demonstrated by the articles I brought home, being deposited at the Royal Institution Museum at Liverpool, when I add that they were obtained from tribes who had no record of ever having been visited by any white man previous to the time of our voyage at the end of 1854. Close quote. There is good reason to believe that, like all inferior races, there has been little or no migration from Africa since the earliest historical records. The European, forever restless, has migrated to all parts of the world, and traces of him are to be found in every quarter of the globe. Everywhere we see the European as the conqueror and the dominant race, and no amount of education will ever alter the decree of nature's laws. We hear much of late in this country of the equality of the Negro and the European, because we have little real knowledge of the Negro. But in America, the Negro is better known. As Dr. Van Ivry observes, quote, "In the United States, among a people almost universally educated, and where the fact of equality is almost universally understood and acted on, personally as well as politically, the advocacy of women's equality, in the sense that they in England argue it, or equality of the Negro to the white man in any sense whatever, is inexcusable on the ground of ignorance, and those thus warring against the laws of nature and progress of society deserve to be treated as its enemies, or as absolute maniacs and irresponsible for the evils they seek to inflict upon it." Close quote. It has been assumed, on very insufficient evidence, that the Negroes in America improve in intelligence in every generation, and that they gradually approach the European type. M. Quatrefages recently directed our attention to this point, as did Sir Charles Lyell many years ago. It is affirmed that the head and body also approach the European without any mixture of the races. M. Quatrefages quotes the following from M. Elise Reclus. Quote, "We do not intend here to touch upon the question of slavery. We would merely state a certain fact, the constant advance of Negroes in the social scale. Even in physical respects, they tend gradually to approach their masters. The Negroes of the United States have no longer the same type as the African Negroes. Their skin is rarely of a velvet black, though nearly all their progenitors have been imported from the coast of Guinea. Their cheekbones are less prominent, their lips not so thick, nor the nose so flattened, neither is the hair so crisp, the physiognomy so brutish, the facial angle so acute as those of their brethren in the Old World. In the space of 150 years, they have, as far as external appearance goes, passed one quarter of the gulf which separates them from the white race." Close quote. We believe such not to be the fact, and that no improvement takes place after the second generation. On this point, Dr. Knott has very judiciously observed, Quote, Sir C. Lyle, in common with tourists less eminent, but on this question not less misinformed, has somewhere stated that the Negroes in America are undergoing a manifest improvement in their physical type. He has no doubt that they will in time show a development in skull and intellect quite equal to the whites. This unscientific assertion is disproved by the cranial measurements of Dr. Morton. That Negroes imported into or born in the United States become more intelligent and better developed in their physique generally than their native compatriots of Africa, everyone will admit, but such intelligence is easily explained by their ceaseless contact with the whites, from whom they derive much instruction, and such physical improvement may also be readily accounted for by the increased comforts with which they are supplied. In Africa, owing to their natural improvidence, the Negroes are more frequently than not a half-starved and therefore half-developed race. But when they are regularly and adequately fed, they become healthier, better developed, and more humanized. Wild horses, cattle, asses, and other brutes are greatly improved in like manner by domestication, but neither climate nor food can transmute an ass into a horse or a buffalo into an ox. Close quote. The real facts seem to be that the Negroes employed in domestic labour have more intelligence than those who are employed at field labour, who are nearly in the same mental condition as when they left Africa. We must bear in mind, however, that there are only some of the African tribes of Negroes who are docile and intelligent enough for domestic purposes. The Igbos are generally selected for this purpose. We see, therefore, in this improvement of the Negro simply the effect of education, but not of climate or other physical agents. We fully admit that the domestic Negroes are improved in intelligence in America, resulting from the imitation of the superior race by which they are surrounded, but much of the improvement in intellect is owing to the mixture of European and Negro blood. The Negro is not generally educated, because it is affirmed that he is no sooner taught to read than he will take every chance of reading his master's letters. And if he be taught to write, he will soon learn to forge his master's signature. This applies with equal, and perhaps greater force, to those free, semi-civilized Negroes who are held by some in such theoretical veneration. I have intentionally avoided dwelling on the great diversity of physical type found in Africa, as this is foreign to our subject. There can be no doubt, however, that there is both in North and South Africa every shade of colour and races with very different features. There are also in Central Africa some races such as the Mandingos, the Fulas and Wolofs, who are quite distinct from the typical Negro. In these races, some of the characters found in the typical Negro are found in only a very modified degree. How many races inhabit Africa and their relation to one another is not the subject of present inquiry. M. Pruner Bay has very judiciously made the following observations on this point. Quote, we must admit that the inferior orbital margins are frequently narrow and retreating, that the noses become longer and more prominent, that the lips turned up in some tribes are only full in others, that prognathism diminishes without however disappearing entirely, that the aperture of the eye becomes wide, that the hair, short and woolly in most, grows longer, that the transverse diameter of the chest becomes enlarged, that even the pelvis, though much more rarely, acquires more rounded outlines, that the limbs acquire more harmonious proportions, that the hips, thighs and legs become more fleshy, and the foot more arched. But as regards the crowning of the work, i.e. the skull, especially the cerebrum, all the variations in the Negro race remain confined within limits which deserve our attention. In the Aryan race, the skull presents three fundamental types. The elongated form, producing in some exceptional cases prognathism, which approaches the limit of the Negro type. The short and round form, approaching the Turanian race. And finally, the typically beautiful oval form, which seems to have resulted from a combination of the two former. nothing like it is to be found in the Negro. Her skull is and remains elongated. It is elliptical, cuneiform, but never round. His facial bones may approach the pyramidal form by the increasing distance between the cheekbones and may, in this respect, resemble the Kaffirs and the Bechuanas, but this is all. Close quote. This generalisation appears to me to be in accordance with all the known facts respecting the craniological development of the chief African tribes, which thus form one great ethnic family, although composed of many distinct races. I need not enlarge on the well-known and admitted facts respecting the intense immorality which exists among the mulattoes and others of mixed blood. There are, at the same time, perhaps some exceptions to this general rule, which, however, has been observed in every country where these people exist. Of all the questions connected with the Negro, the most difficult to settle is that of his intelligence. Amidst conflicting testimony, it is difficult to discover the truth. We may admit, however, that there are instances of the pure Negro showing great powers of memory, such as the acquirement of languages, but we must also remember that memory is one of the lowest mental powers. Numerous instances have been collected by different partisan writers to show that the Negro is equal intellectually to the European. But an examination of these cases nearly invariably leads to the conclusion that there has been much exaggeration in the statements made by the writers as to the aptitudes of the Negro for education and improvement. The exhibition of cases of intelligent Negroes in the saloons of the fashionable world by so-called philanthropists has frequently been nothing but mere imposture. In nearly every case in which the history of these cases has been investigated, it has been found that these so-called Negroes are the offspring of European and African parents. I propose on some future occasion to lay before you evidence to show that nearly all the Negroes who are asserted to have arrived at any mental distinction had European blood in their veins. And I think I shall be able to show that of the 15 celebrated Negroes whose histories were collected by Abbé Grégoire, there is not one who is of pure Negro blood. Some writers who advocate the specific difference of the Negro from the European have very injudiciously admitted that occasionally the Negro is equal in intellect to the European. But this admission has materially weakened their argument in favour of a specific difference. If this is so, let me ask those who hold such an opinion to give the name of one pure Negro who has ever distinguished himself as a man of science, as an author, a statesman, a warrior, a poet, or an artist. Surely, if there is equality in the mental development of human races, some one instance can be quoted. From all the evidence we have examined, we see no reason to believe that the pure Negro even advances further in intellect than an intelligent European boy of 14 years of age. Many writers have mentioned the precocity of the Negro children. Sir C. Lyell has observed, quote, up to 14 years of age, black children advance as fast as the whites, close quote. And Elliot Warburton has remarked that the modern Egyptian, quote, when young, is remarkably precocious in intellect and learns with facility. As he grows up, his intelligence seems to be dulled or diminished. He has no genius for discovery, and though apt in acquiring rudiments, he is incapable of generalizing. He fills subordinate departments well, but appears incapable of taking or of keeping a lead, close quote. Sir C. Lyell expresses his surprise at the results of the mixture of some European blood with the Negro, and thinks, quote, it a wonderful fact, psychologically considered, that we should be able to trace the phenomena of hybridity even into the world of intellect and reason, close quote. It would indeed be remarkable if all men were endowed with the same instincts, but not so wonderful if we do not accept such an unfounded hypothesis. The pure Negro seems incapable of much mental cultivation, and Archbishop Sumner's much talked of, quote, improvable reason, unquote, as a distinction between men and animals, only finds a limited application in the Negro race. The reason of animals is improved to some extent by domestication and training, and this is all that we can say of the Negro. Dr. Madden observes, quote, it will be seen by all the answers the missionary gentlemen in our different settlements have given to my queries respecting the mental capacity of Negro children that they are considered universally in that respect equal to European children, and by some even quicker in their perceptions and more lively in their powers of apprehension, close quote. To which Dr. R. Clark adds, quote, this is observable from the ages of 5 to 12 or 13 years, but from that period of life to the age of 18 or 20, it becomes less strongly marked, and there appears to be less activity in the mental faculties, close quote. Professor Owen gives it as his opinion that we are unable, quote, to appreciate or conceive of the distinction between the psychical phenomena of a chimpanzee and of a Bushman or of an Aztec with arrested brain growth, close quote. But we are able to appreciate the psychological distinction between the Negro and the chimpanzee, just as we see that there are decided mental and moral distinctions between the European and the Negro. We fully admit, however, that the psychical distinction is simply a question of degree and not of kind. The day is not so far distant when we shall be able to analyse the mental character of the Negro far more minutely than we can do in the present infant state of psychological science. In dwelling on the mental character of the Negro, we must, therefore, for the present, rely on the general observations of those unbiased travellers and others who have been much associated with the Negro race. In the first place, we will see what is the evidence recently published by our English consuls, who have the best opportunities of judging of the character of the people among whom they are placed. Consul Hutchinson, who spent no less than 18 years on the west coast of Africa, and who is as competent a judge as any man now living, says that, quote, his own observations on the African tribes tend to show that the African is not exactly the style of man and a brother, which mistaken enthusiasts for his civilization depict him to be. Close quote. He gives the result of 10 years' attendance at the missionary school at Cape Palmas of one of his servants, a crewman, and says that at the end he was asked what he knew of God. He replied, God be very good. He made two things, one sleep and the other Sunday, when no person had to work. Consul Hutchinson says that the thirst for each other's blood, which seems a daily habit among so many of the Negro tribes in Western Africa, appears to me to be incompatible with ordinary notions of common humanity. He says that for scores of years, European missionaries and English traders have mixed with them in social intercourse, yet they still cling to their gree-gree jujus of fetishism and cannibalism with as much pertinacity as they did many hundred years ago. He adds, quote, here we have all the appliances of our arts, our science, and our Christianity, doing no more good than did the wheat in the parable that was sown among the briars and the thorns. To attempt civilizing such a race before they are humanized appears to me to be beginning at the wrong end. I have passed many an hour in cogitating and endeavouring to fabricate some sort of education likely to root out the fell spirit that dictates human sacrifices and cannibalism, but I fear years must elapse before any educational principle in its simplest form can produce an amendment on temperaments such as they possess. Close quote. Consul Burton considers that M. du Chaillu's remarks concerning the commercial shrewdness and eagerness, the greediness and rascality of the Negro apply to him everywhere in his natural state, that an abnormal development of adhesiveness In popular language, a peculiar power of affection is the brightest spot in the Negro character. As in children, it is somewhat tempered by caprice, especially under excitement, yet it has entitled him to the gratitude of many a traveller. Exaggeration, he considers, is the characteristic of the mind of both the East and West African. He says that, quote, they justly hold labour as an evil inferior only to death, close quote. These are the opinions which have been published by the last two consuls who have written on the subject, and we shall now examine the evidence of some other witnesses. Mdu Shalu describes the general characteristics of the tribes he visited, who spoke the Mpongwe language as far superior to the Negroes of Congo. He says, quote, the Negroes possess an imaginative mind, are astute speakers, sharp traders, great liars, possessing great powers of dissimulation, and are far from being in many respects the stupid people they are believed to be. In everything that does not require a mental labour and forethought, they seemed to me to learn almost as fast as any among the more intellectual races to a certain point. Close quote. He further affirms that they have little power of forethought or power of reflection, and that there is a total lack of generalisation. He also says that although these people are often treacherous, they have noble qualities, given to hospitality, and the women show great kindness of heart, especially when one takes into account the way that they are treated. Bream says that, quote, there seems to be a complete absence of moral sentiment among the natives of East Sudan, who not merely excuse theft, murder, and treachery, but consider these actions as praiseworthy in man. They first learned under a Turkish ruler to distinguish murder from justifiable homicide in war. Lying and deceitfulness are considered as marks of mental superiority, and those who suffer death on the gallows are buried with the same honours as the rich merchant or the sheikh. Close quote. Count Gores narrates of the Negroes in Cuba, quote, their character is very degraded, the moral feeling entirely undeveloped. All their actions proceed from animal impulse, or a cunning calculation of their own advantage. Generosity and indulgence exhibited by the white man they consider as weakness. Power imposes upon them and excites their hatred, which would become dangerous were they not aware of their powerlessness. The only efficacious punishment for them is the whip. They delight in sowing discord, are thievish and revengeful, void of any religious feeling. They are given to the crudest superstition. Their frame, however, is well developed and powerful, their teeth magnificent, their legs slender. They digest like beasts of prey. Close quote. This certainly is a severe judgment, and may be partly explained by the large amount of mixed blood in Cuba. Colonel Hamilton Smith thus describes the Negro, quote, the Negro is habitually dormant, but when roused shows his emotion by great gesticulations, regardless of circumstance. War is a passion that excites in them a brutal disregard of human feelings. It entails the deliberate murder of prisoners, and victims are slain to serve the manes of departed chiefs. Even cannibalism is frequent among the tribes of the interior. Notwithstanding the listless torpidity caused by excessive heat, the perceptive faculties of the children are far from contemptible. They have a quick apprehension of the ridiculous, often surpassing the intelligence of the white, and only drop behind them about the 12th year, when the reflective powers begin to have the ascendancy. Collectively, the untutored Negro mind is confiding and single-hearted, naturally kind and hospitable. Both sexes are easily ruled and appreciate what is good under the guidance of common justice and prudence. yet where so much that honours human nature remains in apathy, the typical woolly-haired races have never invented or reasoned out a theological system, discovered an alphabet, framed a grammatical language, nor made the least step in science or art. They have never comprehended what they have learned, or retained a civilization taught them by contact with more refined nations as soon as that contact had ceased. They have at no time formed great political states, nor commenced a self-evolving civilization. Conquest with them has been confined to kindred tribes and produced only slaughter. Even Christianity of more than 3 centuries' duration in Congo has scarcely excited a progressive civilization. Thus, even the good qualities given to the Negro by the bounty of nature have seemed only to make him a slave, trodden down by every remorseless foot, and to brand him for ages with the epithet of outcast, the marked, unceasing proof of a curse as old as the origins of society, not even deserving human forbearance. And true it is that the worst slavery is his lot, even at home, for he is there exposed to the constant peril of becoming also a victim, slaughtered with the most revolting torments. Tyrant of his blood, he traffics in slavery, as it were merchandise, makes war purposely to capture neighbours, and sells even his own wives and children. Close quote.